side, my pleasure to also be the chair of the last invited talk of this conference, which will be given by Dan Bernstein on 10 years of Curiosity 5519. Now, I assume that pretty much everyone here knows Dan, and also, as I'm a former student of Dan, it would be a bit weird to now just advertise all the cool stuff that he has done. So let me maybe instead say a few sentences about Curiosity 5519, because that's maybe something that not everyone here is familiar with. So Curiosity 5519 was a paper that Dan had 10 years ago at PKC. It's the most cited paper from that PKC, and he introduced this elliptic curve called Curiosity 5519 together with very efficient heat exchange using that curve. And well, over these 10 years, not only has this paper been cited quite a lot, but also it turned out that this is actually really being used in the real world. So I would conjecture that probably more than half of the people here in this room have used Curiosity 5519 maybe without knowing it. So it's used, for example, in Apple's iOS, and it's being used in the Signal, formerly TextSecure, Secure Messenger. It is being integrated in UPG. It's been integrated in OpenSSH. So quite a few applications, and I'm quite excited now to hear about how these 10 years went.
All right, thanks. The first talk that I gave about 25519 was a seminar talk on a date that in ISO format is 2005-519. A few months later, I had the software posted just in time for a talk at the Elliptic Curve Cryptography Conference. And I thought that while setting speed records for elliptic curve cryptography, this was also setting speed records for public key cryptography, so it would be reasonable to submit it to PKC. I put the paper online exactly at the PKC submission deadline of November 15th, 2005. And what the abstract of the paper says, there's a little bit about things like timing attacks and key validation, which I'll come back to in a few minutes, but the main emphasis, the title of the paper was Curve 25519, New Diffie-Hellman Speed Records, and the main thing I was advertising in the abstract was that this was more than twice as fast as all the other Diffie-Hellman software out there. To give some context for this, let me rewind a couple decades to when people started caring about the speed of elliptic curve scalar multiplication. This really started with ECM, Leinster's elliptic curve method of factoring integers. Factoring integers with elliptic curves, you can see if you look really small font there, this was published in 1987, but actually he started sending the paper around in 1984. The general idea here was to take, the method he was using was exactly the same as what people were doing previously, using the multiplicative group. And he changed that multiplicative group to an elliptic curve group and varied the choice of elliptic curve. And lots of people looked at this and said, ooh, that's a good idea. Let's do this to other applications of multiplicative groups. So elliptic curve primality proving, for example, it's the same as doing multiplicative group primality proving, but suddenly, inspired by Leinster's paper, people realized that, yeah, it's actually a good idea to start varying the choice of group and using elliptic curves, not just multiplicative groups. And then coming back to cryptography, Victor Miller and Neil Koblitz both realized that it was a really good idea for security to switch cryptography over to elliptic curves. Now, the motivation here, there's this really important attack idea, an algorithmic idea called combining congruences, or in the context of discrete logs, it's usually called index calculus. And this is the fastest attack that we have against classic Diffie-Hellman, assuming there's no quantum computers. If you look at other crypto systems, it's not just Diffie-Hellman, it's something which applies to RSA, it's what gives us the fastest factorization algorithms. It applies to some lattice-based crypto systems. For instance, there's a sub-exponential time attack against the Smart for Caltrian lattice-based crypto system using cyclotomics. And this is from exactly the same attack idea. And okay, Miller and Koblitz realized that for Diffie-Hellman, if you switch to elliptic curves, then it poses a really serious obstruction to this index calculus combining congruences attack idea. And that's held up very well over the last 30 years. Okay, as follow-up papers to these initial papers on saying, hey, it's useful to do elliptic curve operations, there was suddenly a lot of interest in how quickly these could be done. There was already in some of the initial papers, there was some discussion about this, but the really first serious analysis was from the Chudnovsky brothers in the context of ECM and elliptic curve primality proving, and it's also largely applicable to elliptic curve cryptography. They said, all right, let's systematically analyze lots of different ways that you can do scalar multiplication. What are all the possible algorithms we can come up with, and how fast are they? Counted by number of field operations. They also did some implementations to verify performance.
And, well, they had a lot of good ideas in this paper, but they missed some tricks. And one speed up came from a subsequent paper from Montgomery, who looked at, okay, how quickly can we do ECM? The Chudnovsky brothers, they're good at optimizing things. Montgomery is really, really good at optimizing things. And his best performance for ECM, the kinds of elliptic curves he used were looking like y squared, maybe since there's multiple screens, I should use the mouse here, y squared equals x cubed plus ax squared plus x, which is not all elliptic curves, but it's a large fraction of all elliptic curves can be written in this way, and that's using the Montgomery ladder. Well, we call these Montgomery curves, and we call the algorithm from this paper the Montgomery ladder. And this is the fastest way that Montgomery found to implement ECM. It's similar to some things that the Chudnovsky brothers had explored, but more optimized, faster than what they came up with. Now, weird thing happens. If you fast forward 10 years and look at the standards that started coming up for elliptic curve cryptography, they didn't recommend Montgomery curves. They said, let's use y squared equals x cubed minus 3x plus b, which is not the same kind of curve. It's one of the kinds of curves that the Chudnovsky brothers considered, and that and the speed up from that minus 3 is something they came up with. These standards, well, the IEEE standard says that these choices are providing the fastest arithmetic on elliptic curves. And then there's a little citation to the Chudnovsky brothers paper. But I don't think any of these standards even cite Montgomery's paper. So even if you know this much of the literature and you have a little bit of scientific skepticism, you have to start asking questions like, wait a minute, was this, first of all, really the fastest option in the Chudnovsky brothers paper? And then what about Montgomery? I mean, Montgomery said he was getting better speeds out of ECM this way than with, he cited the Chudnovsky brothers paper, and he obviously knew what techniques they were using. And then I've only mentioned a few of the papers on optimizing scalar multiplication. There were papers between 1987 and the standards coming out, and what did they say? So, okay, I started looking through the literature and figuring out how fast things were, and I came to the same conclusions that Montgomery did, that, yeah, he really optimized the hell out of this. If you want to compute n times a point for some variable n, some variable point, want to compute n times a point on a conservative elliptic curve, if you have some really specially structured elliptic curve, then you can do this in different ways. But if you have a like normal random kind of elliptic curve, then the fastest thing out there is the Montgomery ladder. Okay, so why didn't the standards use this? Weird. There's one problem which might be an explanation for what the standards were doing, which is, it's a pervasive problem in elliptic curve formulas, and in lots of different shapes of elliptic curves, this problem, you can easily find the solution explained in the literature, but for Montgomery, it wasn't explained. So here's what the problem is. Elliptic curve formulas, they're always going to have some inputs where they don't work. For instance, if you know the chord and tangent rule, the chord and tangent, those are two different cases for adding points, like do you have a vertical line? There's lots of different possibilities for six different cases in the normal elliptic curve formulas. And okay, we know what all those cases are, and you can implement all those possibilities, and that's really important for cryptography. I mean, it's terrifying for cryptography if you have something that doesn't always work. If there's some cases that you haven't handled, you have formulas that just work for generic random inputs, but maybe there's some exceptional cases, can the attacker come up with some extra inputs which are in those exceptional cases? And then what does your code do? And what is the output of your algorithm? The only safe thing to do in cryptography is have algorithms that work for all inputs. And then, okay, that gives you a good platform for analyzing the higher level protocols. But Montgomery, he was only looking at ECM, and he didn't analyze the exceptional cases in his formulas. I have a picture here from a paper from Bosma and Lenstra in 1995, which says, theorem one, it's looking at any elliptic curve E, says the smallest cardinality of a complete system of addition laws on E equals 2. I should use the mouse again. It's very small font here. So what they're saying is if you have one addition law, it can't always work. It can't be complete. There must be some inputs where that addition law, whatever formulas you're writing down, those formulas have to fail. Okay, so what are the exceptional cases for Montgomery, and how do we deal with those? There's an extra difficulty here, which I want to spend a few minutes on, which is timing attacks. So there was a really eye-opening paper by Paul Kocher in 1996 where he said, look at how much information you're getting from the timing of, say, RSA implementations. And you can also break Diffie-Hellman and so on this way. He said,
if you look at the branches, the secret cases that are happening inside RSA, then those are going to depend on your secret key and depend on the input that an attacker is providing to RSA. And if you just look at the total time and apply some common sense, then you can easily figure out what the secret key is by looking at the timing for a bunch of different inputs. And that's really scary. This woke up a lot of people. It didn't suggest that there was necessarily a problem with, say, elliptic curve cryptography. If you get rid of cases, you can think of ways that you can eliminate cases from things. But, well, okay, how exactly do you do that? It's a problem for the algorithm designer. And then there's actually a further difficulty dealing with timing attacks. Something that Kocher mentioned, the obvious way to deal with timing attacks is write code that takes constant time. Design algorithms that, for every input, take the same amount of time. But that's easier to say than to do. What Kocher briefly mentions is that if you have what you think is constant time code, then, well, time variability can be introduced by compiler optimizations or by cache misses. Let me focus on that cache issue. When you're doing a lookup from memory, loading an entry from an array, in algorithms courses we teach students that takes time one unit of time to load something from an array. But of course, it's more complicated than that. Inside your CPU, that array lookup actually gets converted into a conditional branch. Because your CPU, well, the processing core talks to the cache and says, okay, load this array entry from the cache. And now if the cache has that array entry recently used, then it says, oh yeah, here it is, immediately answers. But if it doesn't, then it talks to main memory, DRAM, and says, please give me this cache line from main memory, and that's going to take longer. So the CPU is converting your constant time code into secret conditionally branching variable time code depending on the address that you're looking up. And this is not just a theoretical possibility, but Dan Page did simulations, and then there was a real attack by Tsunu and Saito Suzaki, Shigeru, and Miyuchi, which was actually breaking a real DES implementation using the timing of memory lookups. Okay, so cache lookups take variable amounts of time. These papers said you can deal with that by loading your entire table into cache. So if you don't have a big table, just a reasonably small table that fits into your CPU's cache, load it all into cache, and then you won't have any cache misses. You have to watch out for operating system interrupts and such. But okay, let's imagine this is inside the operating system. You stop interrupts from happening. You can imagine loading the entire table into cache. But I pointed out that that's not enough, because inside the CPU, there's more aspects of the secret address that you're loading which affect timing, more things that are converted into conditional branches. There are microarchitectural features, which I won't get into the details of, but things called, say, store to load forwarding and cache bank conflicts. And these things mean that, well, you think that you're loading from stuff in cache and that should just take time one, but no, it's not that simple. It takes different amounts of time depending on the different addresses that you're loading from. I wrote some sample code to illustrate that on particular CPUs you could maybe work around all of these effects, but what I recommended in the paper, the clearly robust, safe thing to do, is just never use any secret addresses. So you're not allowed to do any secret branches, no ifs based on secret data. You're not allowed to load any array entries from indices that are based on secret data, or store anything at entries based on secret data, and that obviously stops all of these different sources of time variability. Intel was not happy to hear this, because some subsequent papers said if you're on an Intel chip with hyper-threading, then you can actually break AES and RSA and various other things a whole lot faster. And this makes hyper-threading sound like a security problem. And Intel didn't want to hear that, well, you have to redo all of your cryptographic algorithms in a very restrictive way to never use any secrets in ways that people are accustomed to doing them in algorithms design. So what Intel started saying is, okay, let's put AES into hardware, and we can make that run in constant time. Nobody will use tables for that. And for RSA, they thought they would be clever. Instead of spending a lot of hardware on RSA, they said, okay, people who are implementing RSA and Diffie-Hellman, here's what you should do. You'll typically have a table of, say, 8 or 16 big integers, and you want to look something up from a random spot in that table.
And Intel said, transpose that table. So you've got a 64-byte cache line which has the first word of each of your big integers that you want to look up. And then look up from some entry in that cache line, and they claimed that would take constant time. And then the same for the second word, the third word, and so on, of your big integers. And Intel, well, they said it would take constant time, but because of exactly these same effects like stored load forwarding and cache bank collisions, it doesn't actually take constant time. I was discussing this a few years ago with our session chair, Peter Schwabe, and well, he ended up giving a rum session talk at CHES 2013 called A Word of Warning, saying that this thing that Intel was recommending and that some people were implementing and actually putting into lots of cryptographic libraries, this was not actually guaranteed to be constant time. And we did a little lab experiment to illustrate that this was not constant time. Yeah, there's lots of crypto libraries out there where until you demonstrate an attack against that particular library, they won't rewrite their code. It's not good enough to just undermine their assumptions. So here we are in 2016. It does take a lot of work to go from a lab experiment to a real break of things, but, well, this work was done by Roman, Genkin, and Henninger against OpenSSL, which is, I guess, the most popular cryptographic library. And, well, as a result of that, the most recent OpenSSL security update at the beginning of this month says here's a bunch of patches which are dealing with what's now called cache bleed. Okay, let me get back to my 25519 story. Given the timing of what I said about this other paper, I was, of course, thinking about these issues when I worked on 25519, and I said in the 25519 paper that the software avoids all branches depending on secrets, all array indices depending on secrets, and all other instructions that have timing depending on the secret inputs. But then, okay, how do you do this and still do elliptic curve cryptography and make it run fast? Well, I started with the Montgomery formulas for Montgomery curves and said, here's what you do. Choose a Montgomery curve. And one extra little restriction to enable the theorems in this paper, the parameter A there inside the curve, A squared minus 4 has to be a non-square. Okay, about half of the A's satisfy that. And if you look at the number of elliptic curves that can be written in this way with that non-squareness condition, it's about a quarter of all elliptic curves. So not a big restriction on our pool of elliptic curves to choose from. And then Montgomery's ladder, what it takes as input is it represents a point just by the x-coordinate. If you have an x comma y, there's another point on the curve, x comma minus y. And Montgomery does the n times a point just using the x-coordinate. And if you think about what the nth multiple of x comma minus y is, it's going to have the same x-coordinate as the nth multiple of x comma y. And Montgomery says, okay, let's just work with the x-coordinate, never even look at the y's. And what I said in this paper is don't do exactly that. Just one little tweak, which is if you're dealing with a point at infinity, let's define the x-coordinate of that to be 0. There's many different possibilities for what you mean by the x-coordinate of infinity. Maybe the most obvious thing to say is infinity transmitted somehow. But I said, no, let's transmit that as 0. So you transmit, you sort of equate not just xy with x minus y, but also equate infinity with the point 0 comma 0 on this curve. And then use the Montgomery ladder. And don't bother checking for any exceptional cases. And I proved in the paper that the output always works. Now, there's still that theorem from Bosman and Leinster saying that you can't have elliptic curve stuff always working. But this does always work. And the trick of having it always work is embedded inside this equating 0, 0 with the point in infinity, representing those in the same way, and then the output is going to also have that equating of two different points. But that's fine for Diffie-Hellman. Okay, here's what the Montgomery ladder looks like. If you haven't seen elliptic curve formulas, this is certainly the simplest scalar multiplication algorithm you can possibly write down. It is a bunch of loops, 255 loops for a 255-bit scalar, and inside each loop there's some conditional swaps and there's some field operations and pattern of additions, multiplications, subtractions, and so on. And then at the end returning some x-coordinate of n times p. All right, this is not exactly what Montgomery's paper says and what some subsequent
papers about Montgomery's letter, what they say to do. Because Montgomery says, intuitively, he says, to compute n times p, along with n plus 1 times p, you do that in some recursive way using n over 2 times p, rounded down, and n plus 1, n over 2 plus 1 times p, rounded down. And then that recursion bottoms out at 1 times p, which is just the point p you have as input. And that means the number of loops you're doing depends on how many bits there are in n. Now, n, if you allow n to have as many as 255 bits in it, then, well, there's at most 255 loops, but Montgomery's ladder, in its original form, takes a variable number of loops depending where your top bit is in this number n. If n's between 2 to the 254 and 2 to the 255, then it'll take exactly 255 loops, but it could take fewer loops. And so I took a couple defenses against this time variability in the paper. First of all, I changed, instead of going down to 1 times p, I went down to 0 times p. And then that means that you can always do the same number of loops, always do 255 loops for a 255-bit scalar, even if it happens that some of the top bits are 0. Just start with 0 times p. The 0 gets doubled some number of times, still produces 0, and then eventually it starts moving up towards n times p. And then just in case somebody wasn't listening to me and re-implemented from Montgomery's original paper, I also defined the scalars, the secret numbers n that you're using in the Montgomery ladder, to have always the 2 to the 254 bit set. So there's no leaving 0 bits, and even if somebody does Montgomery's ladder, it will end up doing this constant number of loops. And then what about those conditional swaps? Well, the basic operations also have to take constant time, and in particular, conditional swap you can easily convert into arithmetic, so that also takes constant time. Now, you might have noticed that in this very simple code for doing the scalar multiplication, I didn't actually check whether the input point was on the right curve. And this is something really important, because there's an attack from Beal and Meyer and Mueller, the Crypto 2000, which says, okay, if somebody can feed you bad points, well, those of you who heard the talk yesterday about this, you know all about invalid curve attacks, and this will easily figure out your secret scalar and totally break Diffie-Hellman. All right. This is something where, theoretically, you might say, oh yeah, implementers are competent and they'll get this sort of thing right, but then in the real world, there's attacks like Eddie Sorek's 2015, Yager and Schwenk and Somorowski said, out of 8 Java TLS libraries that they looked at, 2 of them forget to check that the input is on the curve, forget to validate keys. Oops. And so they completely broke those 2 crypto libraries, implementations of Diffie-Hellman. All right, what I said in the paper was, here's how to get rid of these attacks. And this completely eliminates the attacks by the choice of cryptographic system. First of all, the summary of what you get out of what I'm going to tell you about on the rest of the slide is that checking that your input is correct takes no cost at all. Cost, not just negligible, but cost zero. There is no code at all to check that the input is correct, which means that if you forget to put it in, it's the same as putting it in. You always have a valid input. And how does this work? Well, first of all, as I was saying, Montgomery's ladder, Montgomery just uses an x-coordinate. In normal ECC without the Montgomery ladder, people use an x-coordinate and a y-coordinate. And then already in Victor Miller's original paper, he said you could just send an x-coordinate along and then, well, figure out what you need for n times that x-coordinate. But for Montgomery, it's something where you don't have to do any extra work for it. It just naturally happens. And the result of doing this is that the x-coordinate that comes in is guaranteed mathematically to either be a point on the curve that you want or a point on what's called the twist of the curve, or for certain cases like 0 to the point on both. This has, okay, so from a performance perspective, it's a nice thing for people. People really like having a short key, just 256 bits, 32 bytes. But from a security perspective, this also means that the analysis of special cases and different cases coming in boils down to just 2 different possibilities, the curve and the twist. And then that theorem that I mentioned, saying that the Montgomery ladder always works, that also guarantees that points on the twist will also have the correct output. They'll be computing scalar multiplication on the twisted curve. And then you simply have to choose a curve where not just the curve is secure, has some small cofactor, no small order points except for orders dividing small cofactor, 8 in the case of 25519, but you also choose the curve so that the twist has the same property. There's no small order points, except for orders dividing the cofactor. Okay, and so 25519 is not just the prime, which I'll talk about a bit, but the choice of curve. If you follow these rules, then suddenly, mathematically, you're constrained to always have the correct output in a way which, well, you're either doing scalar multiplication on the secure curve, or you're doing scalar multiplication on the secure twist. Okay, I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about the speed of field arithmetic. This is actually the biggest part of the paper, but I figured that I have enough other things to say. Let me just say that, well, of course, for a speed-oriented paper, this was quite a bit of work. Even in the paper, I left out a whole lot of material about automated computer-aided optimization, which I'm also not going to talk about in this talk. I will briefly talk about the prime. There's lots of different choices of finite fields, and of course, if you want things to go as quickly as possible, then you have to choose a finite field where arithmetic is as fast as possible. I went through some different possibilities for finite fields in this paper and said that if you use an extension field instead of a prime field, a quadratic extension or a bigger extension, then, well, maybe it saves time, but I had trouble seeing how it could save time portably across a bunch of different computers, really taking advantage of the different kinds of multipliers available on different computers. And I also said that if you choose a prime field that has the virtue of minimizing the number of security concerns for elliptic curve cryptography. Now, nothing really bad has happened for non-prime fields for ECC, but I think most people would agree that this is the conservative, safe choice to make instead of taking elliptic curves over extension fields. Take elliptic curves over prime fields, and then you have the fewest different attack algorithms to worry about. For instance, you don't have to think about Vegasin. Now, which prime do you choose? Well, there's lots of different approaches here, and you have to dig into the different algorithms for doing arithmetic mod primes to understand why the NIST choices from Jerry Salinas at NSA, the NIST choices of primes are not very good for speed, like this prime, which is a sum of some indifference of powers of 2 to the 32, that's not a very good prime, whereas 2 to the 255 minus 19 is considerably faster. The speed benefit that I was getting over previous stuff, there's some speed up from just this choice of prime, and there's some speed up from doing the Montgomery ladder, especially if you insist on a constant time implementation, and then there's also an unbounded amount of slowdown that people were getting by not doing algorithms very well for doing the multiplication in finite fields. Okay. I had a little bit more in the paper about security. Something which I think it's surprising to me how little this is known among theoreticians is the original Diffie-Hellman paper proposed what is not two parties come up with ephemeral keys and then do an unauthenticated key exchange. What the original Diffie-Hellman paper said was there's lots and lots of users, and then each user has a public key, which is published in a phone book, say. And then as soon as one user sees another user's public key, then they automatically know a shared secret between those two users. Of course, if you simplify this down to two users, and then you simplify the timing down to, well, the users appear and they generate keys, and then they have a shared secret, and then they go away, then it's the very simplified special case of unauthenticated Diffie-Hellman key exchange. But the multi-user version is much more flexible and much more powerful, gives you many more tools beyond that unauthenticated key exchange. So, of course, I specified 25519 as a multi-user Diffie-Hellman system. There's also lots of other practitioner-oriented papers and, well, standards which are talking about, say, static Diffie-Hellman, or NIST always comes up with clever names for things like C02 that's having Diffie-Hellman with long-term public keys for everybody. Of course, if you want short-term public keys or just two users, that's just a special case. I also went through here's different aspects of security. I complained a little bit about reductions. The problem with reductions, if you say, for instance, okay, how hard is it to break this Diffie-Hellman system? Well, you could try to say that's as hard as breaking discrete logs. But even if you say two users solving the computational Diffie-Hellman problem, how does that compare to solving discrete logs? Then we don't know the answer. If you say, okay, discrete logs, suppose we have the best algorithms, 2 to the 120-something operations to break discrete logs on this curve.
And then how quickly can we break Diffie-Hellman, computational Diffie-Hellman? The best theorems say if you assume that discrete logs are this hard, then Diffie-Hellman is between 2 to the 100-something and 2 to the 120-something mark. And then there's a much bigger range if you look at multiple users and start taking account of attacks that might only succeed with 10% probability and so on. So there's really a huge range of possible security levels that are allowed by these security theorems. If you start by saying, let's assume that some simple problem is hard, it doesn't really tell you how hard the crypto system is to break. Which means if you're trying to choose the most secure crypto system, of course you can just say, well, pump up parameters as much as you can afford. But if you're trying to choose between different crypto systems, make the most intelligent choice, get the best security for any particular performance that you can afford, then the theorems give you too much uncertainty in that. And so you can't really intelligently choose crypto systems. You have to, if you want to understand security, you have to base that on the best attacks that are known. If you say, oh wait, there's some crypto systems where we have tight security reductions, the problem is that's always coming at a significant performance penalty. And then you get better security by switching to a different system which doesn't have such tight reductions. So it's really unsatisfactory having loose reductions between crypto system security and underlying problem security. And I went through what the best known attacks against Diffie-Hellman are discrete log attacks. I went through what the best attacks there were, including the multi-user versions of them, batch attacks against a bunch of discrete logs. I said 160-bit elliptic curves are not big enough, taking account of special purpose hardware, and I talked about things like invalid curve attacks, which 25519 defends against. In case you don't care about multi-user attacks and batching across a bunch of users, here's an example of why you should care. This is the logjam attack from last year, and this is doing real attacks in real time, like under a minute, against 512-bit Diffie-Hellman, which before this paper was pretty widely deployed as supposedly providing forward security. People thought that, oh, 512-bit Diffie-Hellman, you can't break that quickly enough to interfere with a connection, but that's just totally untrue because there are batch attacks where you do a lot of pre-computation, and then for each new key that you're targeting in the batch, you have very little extra work to break that key. You can think about this as a non-uniform attack against the Diffie-Hellman problem. Okay, one last thing I'll point to in the paper was an attack model. Now, I don't think of this as anything creative. I was just saying, okay, look, here's what the software would allow a bunch of users to do, and here's the messages they transmit that the attacker, who's, let's assume, a global active adversary, the attacker can see these messages, change messages, pretend to be more users with more public keys. I'm a little surprised at how much some theory papers have been excited about modeling the security of Diffie-Hellman. For instance, there's a PKC 2013 paper by various people which points to a Eurocrypt 2008 paper by some people and says there's a particularly nice model. That's what the 2013 paper says about the 2008 paper. There's a particularly nice model of non-interactive key exchange, which I think of as Diffie-Hellman. And that model is particularly nice because it allows dishonest key registrations. Well, of course you can register a dishonest key via a user who pretends to be another user and make up of your own public keys. This PKC 2013 paper says, well, this 2008 model did not include having a secret key revealed, which is important because of, for example, cryptanalysis. Well, my 25519 paper included explicitly attacks against whatever secret key system you're using, not as reveal queries, but as attacks against that system, which is another parameter. And I also included something which is not in either of these papers, which is modeling the fact that algorithm inputs and outputs are strings, not group elements. And if you want to model something like invalid curve attacks, then you need to do this. So if you're interested in attack models, and if you think that maybe the attack models from PKC 2013 and Eurocrypt 2008 are not satisfactory, then, well, maybe you look at this and get some ideas of how to do better. Okay. Obviously, the main point of my paper was the speed, and for me, I thought, well, setting speed records for things, having twice as fast public key cryptos, anything before that, that should be a good candidate for PKC 2006. And I was happy to get back an email message saying accepted, yay. And then after that, I was also happy to get an email message saying, here's the reviews. I thought people would have some nice ideas for maybe things to say more about in the paper, suggestions for things to do. And here's what review number one said. I think this is a nice engineering work, but not a real research paper. I don't question the correctness, but I question the appropriateness of the paper to the conference. I think it's funny sometimes to look back at reviews of papers, and after 10 years you can appreciate what people are thinking without feeling bad about it. Apparently this reviewer thought that all these departments of engineering, electrical engineering and such, are not research departments. I never know what people are thinking if they say, this is not research. Do they mean this is not new? Or do they mean this is not interesting because it's too easy and I could have done that? Or it's not interesting because I don't care about the topic? There's tons of algorithms papers which are saying, I have a better result for something than previous algorithms. Here's a faster algorithm for something. And I think it's pretty rare for algorithms reviewers to say, oh, this is not research. They might say, I don't care about the algorithmic topic, or that's not a big enough speed up to be worth this conference. But it's weird if somebody says, this is not research. Reviewer number two, I would say, was even more negative. Said, yeah, there's protection against timing attacks, very good speed. But said, on the negative side, the paper does not introduce novel ideas. I guess the twice as fast just came from, wasn't ideas, was typing faster. I don't know what people are thinking. Also does not attempt to prove things rigorously. Also says it's just engineering, not research. Well, okay, just says it's engineering, as if that's a bad thing. Is engineering a bad thing? It's true that, as this reviewer says, I did use the word conjecture something like 20 times in the paper. And the reviewer seems really unhappy that I didn't try to prove things rigorously. So let's look at some of these things. You know, after 10 years, if this paper was, it did get published, and it's the most cited paper from PKC 2006, so probably after 10 years, at least some conjecture from this paper has been proven, right? So let's look at some of these easy things that I should have tried to prove rigorously. Computing the shared secret from the two public keys is conjectured to be extremely difficult. I feel really bad for not trying to prove this. If anybody has a proof of this, $1,000 from me. No strings attached. $1,000 US, not Taiwan dollars. And here's another example of a conjecture, which I didn't try to prove. Obviously a problem with this paper. I said if you switch from a prime to a prime 2 bits bigger so that you allow your cofactor to be changing by 2 bits, because Montgomery curves always have an order divisible by 4, then, well, I said I conjecture that you get the same security level. Switching from one curve, say a curve with cofactor 1 over a certain prime field to a curve with cofactor 4 over prime 2 bits bigger. And surely somebody's been able to prove something about this, that these have the same security level, even if you can't prove that Diffie-Hellman is hard, prove that discrete logs are hard. Surely you can prove some relative thing, right? That these two different systems have the same security level. So $1,000 for that one as well. And that should be easier than the first 1,000.
US dollar too?
US dollars, yeah. These were not the worst review. Reviewer number three. This one really takes the cake. So reviewer number three started with saying, the curve is hardwired into the program, which leaves little flexibility if changes are someday needed. This is about what people sometimes call algorithm agility, where you need to have a whole bunch of different algorithms supported, a whole bunch of different curves. Every single layer of your cryptographic system should have as many knobs and buttons and options as possible, because that's worked really well to give us security so far. Complains that the paper is low on useful content because it's mostly about one curve, same issue again. And then says the writing's really bad, very strangely written, unpleasant to read. The paper is written in what comes across as a rambling, incoherent style. Paper's not readable. Rewriting would be required, would be significant. Not optimistic that would be done. And then as for content, reviewer says can't say results because there are no results aside from some trivial mathematical result. The content, the reviewer is not optimistic, would be significant enough to justify acceptance. And then the reviewer starts going through the sections of my paper and saying that half the sections are useless, so the security level section should be omitted.
the appendices, most of the appendices should be removed. I have four appendices, and the reviewer takes two of them in particular and probably had a third or fourth one in mind. I had one appendix which was called Irrelevant Patents. It was a discussion of irrelevant patents. And the reviewer cleverly says the irrelevant discussion of patents should be removed. Okay, I also had an appendix where the whole point of the appendix was simply to prove that various numbers were prime. Okay, the reviewer didn't want that in the paper. And I had an appendix, I'm not sure which other ones the reviewer wanted removed, like the proof that Montgomery ladder works with his modified x-coordinate, etc. The reviewer says the paper will be of greatest implement to people implementing Diffie-Hellman with elliptic curves. But what if you want to use El-Gamal and other ECC protocols? I assume the reviewer meant El-Gamal signatures rather than El-Gamal encryption, which doesn't do anything that Diffie-Hellman doesn't do. I'll get back to signatures in a few minutes, but even if you believe that elliptic curve signatures are important, does that mean that a paper doing twice as fast algorithms for Diffie-Hellman should be rejected? Well, that's apparently what the reviewer thought. And there was one positive comment from the reviewer, saying the paper is remarkably free of grammatical errors. In the US, we call this damning with faint praise. As for primes, I don't know if you heard about the security hole in SOCAT, where something that was called a prime and implemented in the standard SOCAT utility turned out not to be prime. Still trying to figure out how that happened. So it's a really good idea to suppress proofs that things are primes. Okay, you should be wondering, if these were the reviews that I got, how the hell did this paper get into PKC? I mean, this is ridiculous. There is a little more of an answer. I won't go through review number four. That was not as entertaining as reviews one, two, and three. It even said some more positive things about the paper than just the lack of grammatical errors. It's possible that reviewer number four had a big discussion. I didn't see the discussion, of course. It had a big discussion and convinced other people the paper was worth something. Or maybe the program chairs thought that the paper was worth something. Or maybe...
Was any paper rejected from this conference?
This, I think, had 124 papers submitted, 34 accepted, so similar to PKC these days. I mean, same number of acceptance as this year. I don't know. I don't remember what exactly the number of submissions was this year. Another possibility, yeah, so you could think maybe they had an affirmative action plan for all papers because they needed something. Or maybe, somebody thought that a conference series called International Conference on Theory and Practice in Public Key Cryptography would maybe justify having an occasional paper that might actually be useful for practice. But of course, it's entirely possible, with just a few changes in people on the committee, it's entirely possible the paper would have been rejected. So for young cryptographers in the audience, let me say, don't let the referees discourage you.
Okay, the paper was accepted somehow, and then in the remaining time that I have, I want to tell you about things that have happened after the paper. The next year, beginning of 2007, Tommy and I were new in the Netherlands, and what do? Well, of course, we go to a conference. That's what you do when you're in the new country. So there was a conference at the Lawrence Center on mathematics, algorithms, and proofs. And there was a talk there by Harold Edwards called Addition on Elliptic Curves. And we thought, yeah, we know all about addition on elliptic curves. We're not going to learn anything from this talk. But within 10 minutes, he's showing us things about addition on elliptic curves that we'd never seen before. And then he must have thought that we weren't paying attention. What we were actually doing was working out the performance of these formulas, which was faster than any addition formulas we'd seen before. I won't go through the formulas, I'll just say there's some shape of elliptic curves which is not the usual shape of elliptic curves. There's one case that you can find in papers from Euler and Gauss, but he massively generalized that. And then, okay, we started talking to him about this and looking more at the performance, and wrote a paper called Faster Addition and Doubling on Elliptic Curves, which was slightly generalizing the curve shape, and the same Edwards addition law works for these more general things, which is what we call now Edwards curves. In this curve shape, if you change d to 0, then you get a circle. If you change d, that's not an elliptic curve. If you change d to a fourth power, you get something equivalent to Edwards' original curve shape. But the really interesting case is if d is not a square. And then we proved that these formulas are complete. They have no exceptional cases at all. Very easy proof, and lots of people have reject this proof. Okay, so that's really nice for doing elliptic curve computations, and it applies to 255.19. In fact, the set of complete elliptic, well, complete Edwards curves, elliptic curves that can be expressed in Edwards form with this d being not a square, that's equivalent to the set of Montgomery curves with the same condition that I was using in the 255.19 paper. Okay, so you can use these fast formulas for 255.19, and, well, we looked at the performance, as I said, and the result for Montgomery is, well, it's almost as fast as doing Montgomery. Now, this is the fastest way to do addition that we know, but that doesn't mean that it's going to be the fastest for doing scalar multiplication. The Montgomery ladder is actually not based on additions. It's based on a more complicated type of operation, which makes it faster for n times p, but we get very close to that speed using this pure new addition function. And then as soon as you have a more complicated operation, like, say, double scalar multiplication, then that is going to be faster with these Edwards formulas than trying to use the Montgomery ladder. Okay, this is exactly what we need for signatures. And it's not, well, it's not quite as simple as Montgomery putting this inside a full scalar multiplication algorithm makes it more code than Montgomery, but it's still, it's complete formulas, no exceptional cases to worry about. It's very fast, and it's, well, reasonably simple. And, okay, let's try doing a signature system. So this is Ed25519. And this is joint work with the session chair and the program chair, William Yang, and also with Tanya, who I've mentioned on previous stuff, and student Yang stuff. Since I'm a little low on time, let me say the signature equation here, what you have to verify is you take your public key A and multiply it by a hash of something, where the hash includes some R that's part of the signature, M, which is the message you're signing, and the public key A. Schnorr's original system didn't include that A. And then add that to the point R on whichever curve, and then also take an S, which is a scalar inside the signature, and multiply that by a standard base point B, and check that S times B is equal to R plus the hash times A. Okay, so that's the signature system we're using. It's a little different from Schnorr because, well, again, the A wasn't included in Schnorr, and also Schnorr sends along the hash instead of sending along the point R. Because Schnorr was thinking about multiplicative groups where the hash is going to be a lot smaller to send than an element of the multiplicative group. But for elliptic curves, don't have to bother with that. And then by sending R along, we get to have even a conservative double-sized hash function. Okay, and then we also get rid of the Sony-style stupidity of reusing an R for multiple messages, which is what broke the Sony PlayStation 3 security system. We use a trick from Barwood and Wigley in 1997 of generating R as a secret hash of the message M. And then, of course, Ed25519 uses the curve 25519 elliptic curve in Edwards form for fast scalar multiplication in a more general context than we need for Diffie-Hellman. So that retroactively answers the referee's valid complaint about this not applying beyond Diffie-Hellman. What about more general protocols? Okay, at the same time, lots and lots of people were looking at the performance of 255.19 on different platforms, either for the Diffie-Hellman system, which nowadays we call X25519, or the signature system, Ed25519. In this paper, we looked at some current Intel chips at the time. But already before that and lots of stuff after that, people were optimizing for lots of different platforms. I'm not going to go through the different platforms except to say it's not just big chips like Intel chips and neon smartphones. Those are kind of big chips and GPUs. It's also small chips like FPGAs and ASICs and microcontrollers. ASICs, that's optimizing for hardware, imagining a hardware coprocessor, which people will probably be building within a few years to do 255.19 computations. All of these, it's setting speed records. It's doing really well. It's the best way to do cross-platform performance for conservative elliptic curve cryptography. Again, there's other things you can do that are maybe more special structured elliptic curves, and people have gotten some interesting performance results out of those and hyper-elliptic curves. I don't mean to dismiss all sorts of non-conservative things, but if you just want boring elliptic curves where we have the simplest security story, then this turns out to be good on lots of different platforms. Not just the software platforms that I was thinking about originally, but also hardware. We put out a crypto library, Salt,
NACL, Networking and Cryptography Library. This is providing public key authenticated encryption. So Diffie-Hellman, multi-user public key authenticated encryption. You do Diffie-Hellman with, of course, 25519, and then some secret key cipher and some secret key authentication method. And this is all wrapped up inside one simple function, CryptoBox. And it's one function to generate key pairs, one function to encrypt, one function to verify and decrypt. If you're interested in these crypto library issues and security issues beyond crypto, then together with Lyman Shrub, I have a paper, Security Impact of a New Cryptographic Library, which is about the design of this library. More things that happened. The paper had a brief section saying short code, brief paragraph saying short code, 16 kilobytes of compiled code. And this is something which turned out to be useful for unexpected reasons. The simplicity that leads to that code being short, part of it is the Montgomery ladder is simple, part of it is the prime, it's simple to do the field arithmetic. There's various other things that make it simple to do these computations without very long algorithms. And that allowed us to do tweet sorts. So this is providing the full high security cryptographic library, everything except the performance optimizations, in 100 tweets, under 14,000 bytes of code for a complete usable software library for doing public key authenticated encryption and signatures. Actually, that signatures part, the hash function in the signatures, since we were using SHA-512, that is not really designed to be small, and that ended up being the biggest chunk of code inside TweetSolve. But all the other pieces are reasonably small, and to do elliptic curve cryptography for Diffie-Hellman and signatures and to do all the secret key stuff, it fits in a reasonably small amount of code. And then we added a couple of more authors and started formally verifying some properties of this code. And then the idea of formally verifying elliptic curve code was pushed a whole lot further in work. Well, again, Schwab and Yang are there, also Chen Shu, Lin, Tsai Wang, and another Yang, verifying Curve 25519 software. And something you should notice from these titles and this work, people were really benefiting from just focusing on one curve and not having the complexity of dealing with flexible code. This paper was formally verifying that thousands of lines of assembly software for the main loops of 25519 computation, that those were doing its complete functional correctness. So it's doing exactly what a short specification says this code is supposed to be doing. Something a cryptanalyst could review is equivalent to what the code computes. Okay, it was just main loops and only two implementations, and it was a lot of work to get that done, and there's been various follow-up work which is focusing on, all right, how do we actually push this to complete implementations and make it scalable and easy to use? I'll mention, for instance, David Rusinoff at Intel is doing proofs necessary for a hardware implementation of 25519. I'm not saying Intel is committed to doing the hardware implementation, but he's certainly been putting a lot of time into proofs in the ACL2 theorem prover for making 25519 work. Another project I'll mention with Peter also is GFVerif, which is trying to make it easier, I would say successfully making it easier to use and verifying significantly larger chunks of code, well, complete reference implementation of 25519. The lesson you should get, again, out of these papers, which are focusing on this one curve, it's not that it's, here's one curve which is just accidentally being focused on because we're lazy. It's actually making it a lot easier to do the simple implementations, to audit the implementations, to apply formal verification techniques. Even OpenSSL, which has had lots and lots of bugs in their ECC software, they've started moving to each of the curves that they care about. They do a separate implementation of those curves. So they have an implementation of NIST P256. They have an implementation of NIST P224. They have an implementation now of 25519. Speaking of users, let me finish off with a few slides about people adopting stuff. I think the first big user to announce using 25519 was Apple. So if anybody has an iPhone or iPad or other iOS device, if you've heard about Apple in the news recently, you might be wondering about what they're doing. Like, Apple somehow has the ability to take a phone and have the phone, you turn on the phone, and it's supposed to be able to connect to a network and back up its files to iCloud in a way that the iCloud server, apparently, if you've been reading the news, would have been able to read if this had been done. Where at the same time, that phone does not have the files
unencrypted on its own flash storage. And there's various other things that you hear about Apple being able to do where if you think about them for a few minutes, you realize they must be using public key encryption, and they are. They say, for instance, to have a file stored in encrypted form while the device is locked and unable to read the file, they're using, of course, asymmetric elliptic curve cryptography, ECDH over curve 25519. That's in the small font right here. And they're also using it for iCloud key bags and such. Some people might say that it's just one curve, therefore it's not useful. Apparently some users disagree. Another example where it seems to have been useful is text secure signal. This is what you should use for really easy to use secure messaging and phone calls on your smartphone. SSH now supports 25519 keys, does key exchange, and you can use public keys for signatures. And here's my last slide. The IETF and the IRTF, there's the Crypto Forum Research Group, after a few thousand messages of discussion, they settled on curve 25519 for Diffie-Hellman and signatures, and also a bigger, if you can afford a much bigger backup curve designed the same way, then use curve 448. NIST, the same month, October 2015, that decision was made, NIST reopened its elliptic curve standards for comment, which is their way of saying, okay, we're thinking about this again, what should we actually do? Doesn't necessarily mean that they'll choose 25519, but maybe they're thinking about it. November 2015, Boring SSL, which is Google's fork of OpenSSL, they adopted 25519, and I think it's at the beginning of their default curves list for Diffie-Hellman and signatures. And then, as I said, OpenSSL has now put it into their latest alpha. If you're interested in more users, the last link on this page, INX.com is tracking deployment of 25519 for Diffie-Hellman and for signatures, and you see lots and lots of ways that people are reusing this code, and the simplicity of the code that's providing the security features that people want actually seems to be making a difference. It actually seems to be something that's useful for people, and I'm looking forward to the next 10 years of elliptic curve cryptography. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much. Are there questions for Dan? Big silence. It's really no question. I could probably ask some, but over there.
So, you're advocating kind of single curve, the advantages of single curve code, and I guess with elliptic curves, we kind of conjecture more or less that kind of any curve about the same size gives about the same level of security. But there are other cases where we worry about the constants, the choice of embedded specific constants potentially posing risks. And I'm curious to hear you comment on how we think of and be careful about that distinction.
Yeah, it's certainly an important distinction. So for instance, I'm really worried about the choice of ring inside lattice-based cryptography being a cyclotomic ring, which is something where some simple lattice-based crypto systems like the smart recovery system are broken because of that particular choice of ring. And there's no proof that ring LWE for those rings, it has the same difficulty as ring LWE for different rings, even if you have a ring LWE-based system. Smart recovery is not proven to be tightly equivalent to ring LWE or close to as secure or even loosely equivalent. But if you see a simple lattice-based system being broken because of a particular choice of ring, then you have to ask, is the security of ring LWE the same for every choice of ring? And the answer to that is, as far as anybody knows, there's zero chance of proving anything about this. And you might be able, if you fix all parameters, then suddenly, for theoretical purposes, it turns into a provable question of how secure something is. But as soon as you allow any parameter to go to infinity, then there's no hope of proving anything. And for all practical purposes, there's no hope of proving anything about the difficulty of different rings for ring LWE. Picking on ring LWE is just one example of another type of crypto system where unfortunately, we have no way to figure out what the most secure instances are, aside from we do cryptanalysis and then try to guess where that cryptanalysis is going. I do hope that Ring LWE with a good choice of ring is secure, just like I hope that ECC with a good choice of curve is secure. But it's entirely possible at any moment that somebody comes up with a better attack, which just destroys the favorite ring that we have, the favorite curve that we have, or somebody could come up with an attack that breaks all possible curves or all possible rings. So it's really scary. You can't get the confidence that you want as a cryptographer.
Any other questions? Well, then please join me in thanking Dan again.